I already said some things about slide 13, but let me just repeat the main point here. We have representations of covalent bonds forming using Lewis dot diagrams. So keep in mind how a Lewis dot diagram is properly drawn. You start with the chemical symbol for the whatever atom type it is, like the H, and then you, based on the periodic table, look up what the valence shell is. What is the valence shell for hydrogen? Number one, because it's in the first period. Periods are shells. And so how many total orbitals are in that first shell? Just one. Therefore, you just have to imagine there's one orbital in that space around the hydrogen. So then you figure out how many valence electrons you have, which for hydrogen is one, right? And so you just put a single dot. You only ever draw dots for valence electrons. So for the oxygen, same process. Oxygen is in the second period. So you write your O as the atomic nucleus. It's in the second period, so the valence shell is the second shell, right? Has how many orbitals? No.
Eight.
No. No. It is an integer. So all of those were valid attempts, but none of them is right so far. How many orbitals does shell 2 have in total? No.
Four.
There's an S, which is called the 2S, and there's three different 2P orbitals. 2PX, 2PY, 2PZ, plus the 2S. That's four total. So, conveniently, there's kind of like four sides to that O. You can imagine those as being the four orbitals, right? They're empty at the moment. And the proper way to do this is to figure out now how many valence electrons there are, which is what? For oxygen.
Six.
You don't bother writing those non-valence electrons. They're not going to be involved in chemical reactions because they're deeper, so you don't write them. But you have six to work with, and you have four orbitals. You start by putting them individually into orbitals, so a dot in each orbital, until you run out of orbitals, which we've done now. You still have two more electrons, though. So then you start pairing them up until you run out of valence electrons, and that's why it's like that. But this shows you that there are two orbitals that are satisfied here, those pairs, and those electrons are going to stay the property of that oxygen atom. They're not going to be involved in covalent bonding. They won't be shared. These two will, though. So an oxygen has to get into two different sharing deals, either with one more atom in a double covalent bond, which is what happens when two oxygens get together, or it's going to have to make separate single bonds with two different atoms. Okay, but the other oxygen has the same exact Lewis dot diagram, and it doesn't matter which one, where you draw the pairs. But it's these four electrons that need to be shared. That's why an oxygen molecule features a double bond. And another big point of the slide is that every individual single bond is not one electron, but a pair of electrons, because it's one from each of the two involved atoms. And a double bond, which really counts as two single bonds, is four electrons. Okay, let's go on to 14 then. This is just a table showing you even more representations of covalent bonds, giving various amounts of information. The electron distribution diagrams are kind of nice when you're getting this concept in mind, cemented in your mind, because it shows overlaps of these shells, and those shells in the oxygen one, for instance, features pairs that remain with that oxygen. That's what I was talking about over there. But the ones that are shared are where they overlap. And just as a single covalent bond is much stronger than an ionic bond, a double covalent bond is stronger still, stronger than a single covalent bond. So it's even harder to break. Why is it, by the way? What did we say is the reason that both ionic bonds and covalent bonds are classified as chemical bonds. That's right. When chemical bonds form, you no longer have the same stuff. Those reactants, as they were called before the bonds formed, form chemical bonds in such a way that now you have new substance, like sodium and chlorine becoming sodium chloride. That's an example of an ionic bond forming. Covalent bonds are even stronger, and they give you new substance as well. We'll talk later today about bonds that are not chemical bonds. But it's possible to get an even stronger bond called a triple covalent bond. If you look at nitrogen and do this same thing, nitrogen is also in the second period, right? So its valence shell is number 2. You write down its chemical symbol representing the nucleus. Well, once again, you have 4 orbitals to fill in shell 2, but you have 5 valence electrons, not 6. So you distribute them one at a time until you run out of orbitals, and then you put that remaining one in as a pair. This shows you that only a pair of electrons are going to remain with this nitrogen. The other 3 are going to be shared. So every nitrogen that's a member of a molecule, keep in mind we're talking about building molecules here. That's what covalent bonding does. Every nitrogen that's in part of a molecule needs to be making a total of 3 bonds. It can do that as 3 individual single bonds. It can do it as a double bond and a single bond, which adds up to 3. Or if you get 2 nitrogens together, for instance, they will form a triple covalent bond between them. Nitrogen gas is N2. Both of them are satisfied because they're sharing 6 total electrons, 3 from each, which satisfies both valences. This is actually biologically important because every individual organism that lives, every living organism, vitally requires nitrogen. Can't even imagine life without nitrogen, because we talked about the 4 biological macromolecules that all organisms are made out of. Remember those categories? Proteins, polysaccharides, lipids, and nucleic acids. Well, 2 of those 4, specifically nucleic acids and proteins, have to contain nitrogen in them to exist. Well, it doesn't make sense to even talk about an organism without DNA or proteins. Those are really important molecules. So every organism vitally requires nitrogen to exist. And we are terrestrial animals, so we're used to living on land, and in the fluid that we live in is air, and it is almost entirely nitrogen. Most of the air is nitrogen, but we can't use a bit of that nitrogen, even though we can't exist without nitrogen. And neither can almost any other organism. So this is one of several reasons why we absolutely cannot exist without bacteria, because only certain bacteria and no other organisms are able to break this triple bond and get useful nitrogen out of nitrogen gas, put it into a form that is usable by all the other organisms of the world. All right, well, let's go to 15. And look at this picture of a water molecule. Now, what makes this thing a molecule to begin with?
2 atoms coming together?
No.
Covalent bond?
Covalent bonding. Right? Because that, remember that this is different from how a salt is formed. Salts are formed by a transfer of electrons from the metal to the nonmetal. One-way transfer, it's not sharing, and that process therefore makes 2 different ions, which then attract each other because of their unlike electrostatic charges. And a salt can be as big as you want to make it, depending on how many ions you have, right? It's not a defined sized chunk. A molecule is, because of the sharing. Once the sharing between the two hydrogens and the oxygen is complete, everyone is satisfied and they don't want to involve themselves with other particles. That's why a molecule is a fundamental size. Okay? But yeah, when you hear molecule, equate that in your mind with covalent bonding and vice versa. But up to now, we've just distinguished between ionic bonds, and therefore ionic compounds, salts, and covalent bonds made of molecules. Now, a salt is always going to be a compound. Why is that? What is a compound? Not quite specific enough. An oxygen molecule, for instance, is multiple atoms, but it's not a compound. Yeah?
I think what makes it a compound is that the molecules are stackable, per se. Like, the salt can stack on... Like how you said, there's no predefined thing, there's only a formula unit that goes well.
Yes, all of that is true, but that's not what makes it a compound. Right. For it to be a compound, there have to be two or more different elements in that structure. Well, that's always true for a salt, because what two things are involved in making a salt in general?
A metal and a non-metal.
A metal and a non-metal. Those are different elements, right? Well, water is a compound too, but it's a covalent compound. It's made up of different elements, oxygen and hydrogen. But an oxygen molecule, like in that previous slide, is still a covalent substance. It's a molecule, but it's not made of two or more different elements. It's made of two atoms of the same element. So it's a molecular element, right? It's still an element. It's just a molecule of it rather than an atom of it. You see the difference there? So salts have to be compounds. Molecules don't have to be compounds. They can be elements or compounds. Water is a compound. Okay, but anyway, so far all we've had is this dichotomy of chemical bond types. Ionic versus covalent. Now, once you realize, given some structure that you're looking at, that you're not talking about an ionic bond, but covalent bonding, And think about this just in terms of the individual bond for the moment, not the whole structure. But what I'm saying is, once you have in your mind clear the difference between an ionic and a covalent bond, now we can subdivide the category called covalent bonds into two subcategories. There are two types of covalent bonds, which are called polar covalent bonds and nonpolar covalent bonds. And we often don't bother saying covalent. We just say polar bonds or nonpolar bonds. So the distinction, of course, linguistically, is based on polarity. Now, polarity is, the word is used a lot of different ways, but it always refers to the fact that there are two poles, meaning two places that are, in some respect, quite different from each other. Like the north and south pole of the globe, for instance, or of a magnet. Here, polarity, the difference between the poles that we're talking about here, has to do with electrical charge. All right, now remember that both of these categories, polar and nonpolar, are covalent bonds. And therefore, by definition, they're both arrangements in which electrons are shared by two atoms involved. They're both covalent. And it's a pair of electrons, remember, always, that's shared, not a single electron. Or some number of pairs, I should say. Single, double, or triple bonds with one, two, or three pairs. So that's true for both categories. That's not the distinction. But if you think about sharing situations in society or with your friends or whatever, you've probably come to realize that not every sharing situation is absolutely equal sharing. Right? One member in the deal might share more than the other. And that's true also for atoms sharing their electrons in a covalent bond. And if there is equal sharing of that pair of electrons between the two atoms, then that will make for a nonpolar covalent bond. If there is not equal sharing, then there will still be sharing, just not equally, and therefore that bond that's formed will be classified as a polar covalent bond, which I'll explain why in a minute. But this brings up a new definition called electronegativity. Any given element on the periodic table has some value for electronegativity. It could be a low number or a high number. But what electronegativity indicates numerically is how greedy, more or less, that atom is for electrons. It wants it for the higher the number of for electronegativity, the more that atom wants to keep those electrons for itself. It reluctantly shares, in other words. A lower electronegativity means that atom is more willing to share. And the trend is not perfect on the periodic table, but generally speaking, the values for electronegativity are low in the lower left corner for those elements and get bigger and bigger as you go up and to the right, except for the noble gases, which are nice and happy, right? They don't want to make any changes. They don't want to be doing any sharing because they're stable. So notice fluorine is in that, when you exclude the noble gases, fluorine is in that upper right-hand quadrant. And it has the highest electronegativity value of all elements. Oxygen, notice, though, is right next door to it, also very high compared to most elements. So oxygen is greedy when it comes to the sharing. Hydrogen, not so greedy. And never forget that hydrogen, despite being over there on the left on its own, is a non-metal. Non-metal. Why does it matter that it's a non-metal to what we're talking about? Because we're talking about covalent bonds, right? Only non-metals are involved in covalent bonds. If it's a metal and a non-metal, it's ionic. If it's two non-metals, it's covalent. So hydrogen qualifies for forming covalent bonds, like in water. Okay, so there are two covalent bonds in this water molecule. They're identical because there's two hydrogens and one oxygen, but the two bonds are separate from each other. It's two separate deals, in other words, but they happen exactly the same way. The oxygen, though, has a much higher electronegativity than the hydrogen. And so it says, yes, I'll share mine, but I really want custody of the pair most of the time, or more than half of the time, because of that electronegativity difference. All right? And therefore, that pair of electrons that shared, which we don't know exactly where they are at any given moment, we know that they are going to spend more time near the oxygen nucleus than near the hydrogen nucleus. And keep in mind what electrons are, the things that are being shared. They are negatively charged particles. Therefore, where they are makes that region negative, right? And where they're not as often, which is at the hydrogen end of the bond, is going to be not negative. It's going to be positive. Because this still has a proton there to stay in place, right? That's positive. And when the negative electrons aren't there as often, the positivity shines through. It's not counteracted by the negativity. So that means this bond that forms is polar. It has two ends that differ with respect to charge in this case. And in this case, it's the oxygen end that has a slight negative charge because that's where the electrons are more often. And the hydrogen end is slightly positive because that's where the electrons are less often. Now, this is not a complete transfer of those electrons permanently. Otherwise, it would be an ionic bond. And ions forming with an ionic bond because of the transfer of an electron become fully charged, right? One of them becomes fully positive, one of them becomes fully negative. The nonmetal becomes negative, the metal becomes positive. That's full charges. Here, we don't have full charges because the electrons are still spending some time here and here. So it's a partial charge between 0 and 1. And that's why we use this delta notation. This is a lowercase Greek version of a D, a delta. Delta minus is a slight negative charge. Delta plus is a slight positive charge. In general, this is just one example, but in general, whenever there is a polar covalent bond, whichever of the two atoms has the higher electronegativity is going to have the slightly negative charge to it, and whichever one has the lower electronegativity will have the slightly positive charge for exactly the same reasons. All right, now, this is the reason you exist. You can't overstate the importance of this because polarity, the fact that water is a polar compound, gives it a lot of special properties that have allowed life to evolve. And that's why water is absolutely indispensable to life, and that's why when we look for extraterrestrial life, it really is a matter of looking at planets and seeing whether there could be water there. That's what they're really doing, checking for water. Because if it's no, they just move on to another planet and try to find water there. With no water, no life. And there are so many special properties to water that those are discussed in the next chapter, which we'll start today. But that is a polar covalent bond. And if you have a polar covalent bond in a compound, then the compound itself, the whole molecule, is polar. If the molecule is made up of only nonpolar covalent bonds, then the molecule is nonpolar. Now, I hope it makes sense to you, but tell me if it doesn't, that if you have a polar molecule, it must be a compound. Does that make sense? Or can you explain why that's true? Right, exactly right. For it to be polar, the bonds need to be made between atoms that differ substantially in their electronegativity values. Well, if you have two atoms of the same, which you would by definition if it's not a compound, right? Two of the same element, they're going to have identical electronegativities because they're the same kind of atom. And so think of an oxygen molecule. That's a molecule of two oxygen atoms. I already told you that oxygen is greedy. Each one really wants the shared pair for itself. But the other one is just as greedy, identically greedy. There is no difference in their electronegativity values, and therefore neither one wins out. And those two electrons end up being equally shared. Equate in your mind equal sharing with nonpolar covalent bond. And therefore, oxygen as the overall molecule is nonpolar. Now, a compound might be polar. It doesn't have to be, though. Strictly speaking, it would have to be, because every element has at least a slightly different electronegativity value. But when you get two different elements their atoms together and they're sharing. If the electronegativity values are very close to each other, even though they're not identical, then it is pretty equal sharing, and we classify those still as nonpolar covalent bonds. For instance, carbon and hydrogen are not identical electronegativity values, but if you look them up, you see they're pretty damn close. And a carbon-hydrogen bond is a nonpolar covalent bond, despite there being two different elements involved. So an element, a molecular element, definitely is going to be nonpolar because you have identical molecules and only one element. A compound, if it's a compound made of two different nonmetals, it's a molecule, and it might be polar and it might not be polar, depending on the difference, if any, between the values of the electronegativities for those atoms that are involved. Is that all clear? All right. Nonpolar, because for it to be an element still when it's a molecule means that you can only involve one kind of atom. Otherwise, it would be a compound, right? Oxygen molecule is an element because both of the atoms are still oxygen. It's not two or more elements, which a compound would have to be. And since they're the same identical atoms, they're going to have identical electronegativities. And if they're so, there's literally zero difference in their electronegativity values, therefore equal sharing. Now in 16, we can see this same water molecule and another polar molecule below it, just as an example, ammonia. Now it could be two water molecules, two ammonia molecules, or two of any polar molecule. But the point here is that when two polar molecules get close to each other, there is an attractive force between them, which we call a hydrogen bond. It's called a hydrogen bond because typically hydrogen is one of the members of the bond, of the molecules. It's just often the case because hydrogens fill in the spaces to complete bonds so many times. There's a hell of a lot of hydrogen out there. But what we still would call a hydrogen bond doesn't actually have to involve a hydrogen. It just usually is the case. Well, this is an example of what I've been saying exists before. I just hadn't given you an example. Namely, a bond that is not a chemical bond. A hydrogen bond is much weaker than an ionic bond. And so it doesn't hold these things together to make new stuff. That's why it's not a chemical bond. But it still is an attractive force, which is more than zero. All right, so if you imagine two molecules that are nonpolar, like two oxygen molecules, they might bounce off of each other, but when they get close to each other, there's not a force of attraction. They're basically ignoring each other unless they bounce off of each other. Because being nonpolar, they don't have any partial charges, and therefore two of them can't have difference in charges since they don't have charges. Right? They're just neutral. But that's not true for polar molecules. They have these partial charges. So when one polar molecule encounters another, they will swivel. The molecules will swivel in such a way so that the slightly negative end of one polar molecule will be situated next to the slightly positive end of the next polar molecule. Because unlike charges attract each other, right? Slightly positive and slightly negative attract each other. Just like fully positive and fully negative charges attract each other in an ionic bond, that makes new stuff. This doesn't. But it causes these things to act a little bit differently than they would if they were nonpolar. And so even though hydrogen bonds are not chemical bonds, they really make a big difference into how things work. And they really give water all of these special properties, which is why hydrogen bonds, you can think of it this way, hydrogen bonds, weak as they are the reason that organisms, including you, exist. We'll have more to say about that in the next chapter, but let's just finish off these couple last slides. In 17, you can see the water molecule again that we've been looking at, and maybe you were wondering why it has this bent arrangement rather than you might have just thought to yourself, well, it should be straight to be nice and symmetrical. Well, actually, that's a symmetry too, but straight across you might have guessed is how it would be. But it's not, and the reason is that oxygen has four orbitals in its valence shell, right? And those four orbitals, which contain electrons, all of which are negatively charged, actually change their shape such that each of the four orbitals is trying to get as far away from the other orbitals as possible because negatives repel each other. There's an attraction between a positive and a negative, but between a positive and a positive or between a negative and a negative, there's a repulsion. Just like when you get the same pole magnets together, they push rather than pull together. So if you have four orbitals, four spaces in around the nucleus, and those are trying to get as far away from each other as possible, there's only one geometrical way that can be maximized, the maximum spacing apart. And that is if you form a tetrahedron and put those four at the four corners of the tetrahedron. A four-sided die, for you gaming nerds, is what the tetrahedron is. All right, so the oxygen is in the middle of that die, that four-sided die, and the four orbitals are at the corners. But remember, two of those orbitals are filled with a pair of electrons that aren't going to be shared. So that's at two corners. The ones that are shared are where the hydrogen atoms are in the water. And that's why it has that angle defined by the geometry of the tetrahedron. Does that make sense using that picture? You see what I'm talking about there? Similarly, in a methane molecule, which is the simplest possible hydrocarbon, we'll talk about hydrocarbons a little later, made up of only carbon and hydrogen, you have carbon in the middle, in the thickness of the four-sided die, and the four corners are all occupied by hydrogens because carbon with its valence of four is making four total bonds, in this case four individual single covalent bonds with four different hydrogen atoms. And so when you make this with a modeling kit, it will actually look like a tetrahedron. This one won't because you don't have balls representing those unshared pairs of electrons at the two corners. Now to 18, which I think is the last slide in this chapter. What we're looking at here are two examples of what are called chemical signals. Now, signals cause things to happen in organisms that wouldn't happen without the signal being there. And there are electrical signals. This is how our nervous system operates by. That's one type of signal that the nervous system operates by. But there are also chemical signals, which are molecules, but the molecules act as signals. And one really important point about a chemical signal is that it won't have any effect on any cell unless and until that chemical signal binds to a protein acting as what we call a receptor, either on the surface of the cell or inside the cell. So these purplish, well, they're purplish on my screen, it looked blue here. Anyway, these globs are proteins. They are examples of membrane-bound proteins because they are part of the membrane, right? Not membrane-bounded, membrane-bound proteins tied to the membrane. They are the receptors. And a receptor is like a lock in a lock and key mechanism. You have to use the right key with the right shape to fit into the corresponding shape of the lock, right? And so receptors are specific for certain kinds of signal molecules. Well, if a cell doesn't have the receptors for that kind of signal, it won't know that signal is there and it won't have any response. If you think back to my example of positive feedback, what example did I give you? Childbirth, parturition, right? And I told you that oxytocin is released. It's a hormone. Hormones are examples of chemical signals, and hormones are put into the bloodstream. So the entire body gets that signal, but almost none of the body, none of the cells in the body know that oxytocin is there, simply because they don't have the right receptors. The uterus does, though. It has the receptors. So that's the only way you'll have an effect for a signal molecule is if there is a, not only if there's a receptor, but the signal has to bind to the receptor to have any effect. This binding of a signal to a receptor, by the way, reminds me to give you a definition that's even more general than signals. Signal molecules are examples of ligands. This ligand word is real general. To ligate means to tie or to bind, like a surgical ligature, same root. Just means to bind. And so this is a real general word, ligand, because it simply refers to any particle that binds to a protein of some sort. And that's done for various different reasons, including, just as an example, signal molecules binding as ligands to a receptor protein. But whether it's a signal molecule or any other kind of ligand binding to a protein, the general consequence of that binding event is that the protein will undergo a shape change, which we call a conformational change, because conformation is just another name for the shape of a protein. You can see, for instance, endorphin here binding to this receptor. If that happens, then the receptor itself will change shape. And that's how the cell knows that the signal is there. That shape change causes things to happen in the cell that wouldn't without the shape change. Okay? Well, getting back to these two specific examples here, you have natural endorphin on the left and morphine on the right. They're both chemical signals. But the natural endorphin is an example of an endogenous chemical signal. And that's the endo part of endorphin is for that reason. Endogenous means created, gen, within, endo. That means we make our own endorphin molecules within our body. The one on the right is morphine. It's exogenous. We don't create morphine in our bodies. It's outside of our bodies, and we could put it into our bodies. And therefore, exogenous signals go by another name, which we call drugs. Drugs are chemical signals as well. If they're introduced into the body, they do things because they bind to receptors that our body has in them. And the point here, using these two specific examples, is that it's not the entire molecule of a chemical signal that really matters so much. As you see, the endorphin is much more complex molecularly than the morphine molecule. But the part that's in the box is really the only part that fits in. It's the only key part. The rest of this is like a key chain. Doesn't matter what you have hanging off the key, right? The key is what fits into the lock. And morphine has a similar piece of it that's basically the same key. So it can fit in there as well, which is why morphine will give you similar effects to natural endorphin, a feeling of euphoria. And this is exactly what pharmaceutical companies do when they design drugs. They learn as much as they can about receptors, and they try to design chemicals that can fit into those receptors to do various things. All right, that's that chapter. Let me change recordings.